Hey everybody, thanks for joining us. I'm going to cut to the chase really quick here. It's not often that you get to interview a legend, but we got to do that. I got to sit down with James Urbaniak and Jeremy Guskin to interview Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. It was great. It's wonderful. He wanted to talk about Bob and Ray. We still talk a lot about Firesign Theater, and my hopes are that we're going to get together and talk more about Firesign and Phil's other influences. So enjoy this. The clips run a little bit long because Bob and Ray are impossible to cut short. They're kind of slow burns on some of this stuff, and they're just long, great sketch comedy, a lot of wonderful, absurd stuff that you can hear echoes of and probably some of your favorite stuff. So anyway, enjoy this episode, and thanks for listening.
Everybody, thank you so much for joining me. This week, I am lucky to be with Mr. Phil Proctor from Firesign Theater.
Yes.
That's a nice intro I'm hearing.
Yes, you are.
I am casting a huge shadow on all of us in a good way.
And who else is in the room with me?
I have Mr. James Urbaniak, and I have Mr. Jeremy Guskin.
James the Maniac and yeah. Jeremy
whatever.
The Maniac.
Yes, yes. Sure,
whatever. That's true.
He played a pretty crazy character, and you can't take it with you.
Yeah,
it was... But I'm glad you did, because otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Yeah, though, maybe. Yeah. Well, I sleep underneath the stairs. So.
Are you boys talking theater?
Yeah, we talk a little bit of the theater.
That's because we're members of the Antius Company. Are you a member of the company?
I am not. I was actually put up for membership the last time, but I got...
They didn't put up with you.
I got a little bit of a nix because they said they hadn't seen enough of my work.
But you were practically naked in the last thing.
I know.
Yes. I don't understand.
I was wearing a loincloth.
A loincloth.
Essentially,
yes.
A diaper.
Well, that's that was just
and they
a little
wanted,
too much.
And they wanted more.
Yeah.
Oh,
I know.
They did. Okay.
They always want more.
It wasn't the opposite.
But anyway, the Antius Company is in North Hollywood, and it's really one of the very best classical theater companies in all of Los Angeles.
Oh, absolutely.
And it has Jeremy and myself and an incredible roster of other lesser actors, but they're
sure.
still.
Sure.
You know, we set a standard and they try to achieve, you know, to reach that goal. But it keeps them on their toes.
Of course.
You know,
of
right?
course.
Unless they're wearing shoes, in which case keeps them on their taps.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But right now we're presenting Mrs. Warren's Profession.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I will be in the next production of The Crucible.
Oh.
Which is all about the Proctors, about my family.
Uh-huh.
Indeed.
So
my cursed family, my hysterical family.
But, playing Abigail.
I will
obviously.
Be, you know, I will be playing. It is going to be a gender and race blind.
Uh-huh.
Now that we're going to do it in the dark.
Oh, nice.
You know, so
very
nobody
nice.
Can really tell.
Right.
And I think that'll add also to the feeling of
saves on
mysticism
electricity.
And horror.
Yes.
Also.
Arthur Miller's dead, so who gives a shit?
Right, exactly.
I've
right.
been cast as the stone on Giles Corey's chest.
And I am Giles
kills
Corey.
Yes, yeah,
so they're looking forward to working very closely.
Will you be naked again in this one?
But Jeremy,
no, I was body paint.
But Jeremy, looking at you right now, all I can say is more weight.
Yes, thank you.
You have to eat more before
we do
the show.
Yes, that's what they said to De Niro, I think. Right, more weight.
So you can tell that that company has got to be pretty eclectic and crazy
yes.
if Phil Proctor is in it, you know, up to his neck. And I was introduced to it through my wife, Melinda Peterson, who has been with the company for like 15 years, and I've been with the company for about 14 years.
Oh, wow.
And Dakin Matthews, I guess, was the
oh, indeed.
Created it originally.
A little TV shot with Dakin earlier this year in New York.
Oh,
he's
good.
A lovely guy.
Good. Oh, he's a wonderful, wonderful person. Very creative. And he's been the stone upon which all of this stuff has been built.
There you go.
And by the way, how did you get in touch with him? Was this through...
Through your website.
Through the website.
Yes.
Good.
Yes, sir.
Well,
I turned him on to it.
That website caught another fly. I'm glad to hear that.
And I've done... This is my third time doing comedy on vinyl. Jason emailed me and said, I'm talking Bob and Ray with Phil Proctor. And I said, when? You're kidding.
Yeah, so let's get to it.
Yes, let's do it.
Yes.
Here, you
want to
grab the album? Sometimes this helps people.
There
makes
it
them happy to touch.
For those of you listening, I'm going to hold the album up so you can see it.
Mm-hmm. Now you hold it forward a bit because it's reflecting.
Oh, it's reflecting too much?
The microphone.
So I apologize for those at home.
This is Bob and Ray,
with
the two
and only. A nice Mort Drucker caricature.
Beautiful.
The boys.
Yeah, Mad Magazine, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely beautiful.
It's a great picture.
Yeah, well, Bob and Ray were, I guess, really the first truly comedic influence on me from the perspective of performing skit comedy, performing comedy. And many other individuals, you know, caught my eye and ear when I was younger, primarily Ernie Kovacs.
Sure,
on television. You know, and there he is right now, just outside the bookends. That's right. And before that, you know, people like Robert Benchley on the written page. I was always attracted to the absurd in comedy, and that's probably because I come from an absurd family. I'm of Irish and Amish ancestry, which means that half of me is going to get roaring drunk later this weekend for St. Patrick's Day, and the other half will probably be whipping me, and I'll have to do atonement and everything. But being of an Irish Amish family, which is crazy to begin with, everybody had a really great sense of humor. And when they drank, it got even better. I mean, when you're from an Irish family, first of all, when somebody dies, it's a time to party. Okay. So right there and then, I knew I was incarnated into the right place. You know, hey, somebody died. Let's party. Look at all the cakes. Oh my God, this is great. So and everybody always telling absurd jokes. I come from the Midwest, from Goshen, Indiana, where I just returned from a performance with the LA Guitar Quartet of a one-man reading of Don Quixote that I inherited from John Cleese because he couldn't tour with it. God bless him.
That's amazing.
Thank you, Mr. Cheese. That's his real name.
Yes, John Cheese.
John Cheese. Right. And his performance was very cheesy. Mine is a little more refined, you know.
I'm going to tell him you said that.
No, he was actually relieved that somebody was able to take over the role because he was on his alimony tour.
That happens a lot in show business. There's a lot of alimony.
Well, actually, that was something just that kind of just happened recently. A friend of mine, we're watching baseball or some sporting event, and we saw two commercials in a row that had Stevie Wonder songs in them. And we're like, wow, that's amazing. Like, I can't believe they got Stevie Wonder to, you know, like, do the Bud Light ad. And I'm like, I think he's got a daughter in college. Yep. So there that is.
Is he blind?
In real life?
Yeah.
No.
It's all act.
I know. It's real. And he commits to it.
So well.
I think, I'm just wondering, his agent probably was working behind his back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because I saw him in the bathroom just with his glasses off, peeing all over everything, giggling his ass off. And I'm like, I knew it.
Counting a stack of bills.
Yeah. Oh, and full. And like you could tell because they were foreign.
He's pissing his money away.
Yeah.
Not Bob and Ray comedy. This is not Bob and Ray comedy. Okay. No, that's the other thing that appealed to me about Bob and Ray was that they were so uncommonly common in their comedy. Now, you know that they didn't write all their material.
I had assumed.
It's a guy named Koch who wrote almost everything that they did. But in those days, I suppose, at least the philosophy was that you shouldn't admit that you have writers. Right. Also, they were working in a very soft medium. They were working in radio.
Yeah.
And it's easier to disguise what you're doing in radio, you know. I regret only one thing. Well, I should explain, first of all, that I heard them not first on vinyl, but I heard them live on the radio on WNEW, something like that.
WOR in New York. WOR
in New York.
In the 70s.
Yeah, well, this was in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And they were on some station in New York, and they were on 6 o'clock to like 9 o'clock in the morning. And my dad, who was an entrepreneur, used to bring all kinds of inventions into the house. So we had a wire recorder. Well, first of all, we had a vinyl recorder.
Oh,
and
God.
I have a record of me singing a Christmas carol. Rolling my R's because it was all chorus work. You know, we taught to roll our R's, you know. So we could hear those R's. You know. It was a pirate chorus group. Actually, we did a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan at Alan Stevenson School. So Pirates of Penzance was my first lead female role, actually. I played Mabel. I was a boy soprano. That's why I ended up doing Howard on the Rugrats because I was familiar with this range of my voice. But I am drifting. You see, I'm drifting away.
It's okay.
Going back to listening on the radio, we had these recorders, and by this time, my dad had purchased for me a recorder with a built-in radio, a tape recorder, reel-to-reel. And so I would go off to school to play the violin in the Alan Stevenson School Orchestra in the morning, 7 o'clock or so. Mom would record the show from when I left. And then I would come back and listen to it while I did my homework. And I would save the funniest parts of the show very crudely. I just cut them with scissors and put it together with scotch tape on a reel. Well, I refined that a little later, you know, when I learned how to actually edit, which turned out to be my scholarship job at Yale, by the way. Wow. I edited a show called Yale Reports, and I then saved all of the outtakes and the mistakes that these famous people were making who were being interviewed and put it together into a tape called Yale Distorts, which has so people crazy. You know, like Henry Kissinger going, yes.
That's amazing.
Oh, it's great. It was playing in one of the Fireside Theater shows,
okay,
which is now available. 85 hours of our shows are available on an MP3, what a world, which is stuck in the back of a book called Duke of Madness Motors.
Oh, this is the new one.
This is the new one. Oh. It's about a year old now, but it's really been selling well. You can go to the Fireside Theater website if you don't have a copy yet, firesigntheater.com or planetproctor.com, and then link. The wonderfully magical link.
Yes,
to it.
And while you're there, I have to throw out, if you are getting the book, please get a Ralph Spoilsport license plate frame,
yes.
Because whenever I see any of them on the streets, I honk like a madman and always get a great reaction. They're great. And nobody, you have to read it to get it, so the
That's
people
right.
who put it on there, I love it.
Lord Smith, I raise cranberries, I own cranberry bogs.
That's very interesting. I've always been curious about how cranberries are grown. You have to be very careful of frost, don't you?
Oh, yes. If there's danger of frost, you have to flood the bogs. And then you pick them when they're big and red and ripe and juicy and bitter as anything.
This is Wally Ballou with a cranberry story, fast-breaking, here in Times Square. Tell me, Mr. Smith, you harvest cranberries in the fall, don't you?
Yes, you do.
After you harvest them, do you have your own processing plant?
What do you mean by that?
By that I mean, do you have your own factory for squeezing the juice out of the cranberries?
Squeezing juice out of cranberries?
Yes, for your cranberry juice cocktail, like that.
Well, I never heard of that.
Well, do you sell them to people to make jelly out of?
Jelly out of cranberries? Well, what is it, pectin in them or something?
Well, I don't know what's in them, but I know you do make jelly out of them. Cranberry sauce is very delicious, too. That has the whole cranberry in it.
Well, what's that, like a dessert you pour over ice cream?
No, you serve it as a side dish with old turkey or other kinds of meat.
Uh-huh.
Cranberry sherbet is a nice dessert. Very
never
refreshing.
Heard of that.
I think you've been missing a lot of the uses for cranberries, Mr. Smith.
Well, can you make other stuff out of them, like glass?
Yeah, it's something like, and you take any freeway or take the freeway.
Yeah, take the freeway in any direction. Yeah, that was it, I think, is what it says.
If you go to the website. It's so fascinating because it makes your work in Firesign so inevitable, hearing about you growing up sort of in the Midwest in a kind of techie household with lots of recording equipment.
No. But my life is more complicated than that.
All these elements actually add
they
up
do
to
add
what
up.
You're later doing
they
with the
do,
group.
But it's much more like fractured than that. Fractured flickers. I was raised, I was born in Goshen, Indiana, where I say I just performed. It was wonderful. I got to see an old girlfriend and some of my buds we used to hang out with and ride bikes all over town. And some of my relatives who were still out there, it was great. And I went back to the old house where my grandparents lived on Monroe and Fifth, the great old brick house, and got a tour of the place.
That's
and
awesome.
it was really a magnificent opportunity to get back to my roots. But we left Elkhart, where my dad and mom were living, born in Goshen, raised in Elkhart, when I was about 4 or 5, because my dad joined a law firm called McNutt, Longcope, Proctor, and Lee down on Wall Street. Paul B. McNutt was the ex-ambassador to the Philippines who was going to run for president at one point.
By the way, that's kind of like the name of a law firm in a Bob and Ray bit.
or, you know, maybe a Stooges, you know, Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe.
It's a law kind of quintessentially American sounding.
Right, that's exactly
right. And my dad was going to be his vice presidential candidate, and they were going to announce this at the Democratic Convention. And then Paul V. McNutt went on a little cruise, a lot of cruises in the news. Cruise in the news, and discovered that he had throat cancer, and came back and died.
Shit.
Which was the end to my dad's ambitions as a vice presidential candidate, although he was always active in the Democratic Party in New York. So we're in New York, but I spent all my summers back in Goshen. Mm-hmm. See? And so I really, my formative years growing up, I'm going to this great school, Alan Stevenson School, and singing in these shows and playing the violin and having a grand old time and learning things and speaking French and all this. And then I'd go back in the summer and meet Quinn Robinson and Dayton Dallas, you know, and hang out on my bike and play war games and build rocket ships. And, oh, we just had a ball. So I had this wonderful Midwestern childhood mm-hmm. balanced by all this, the intellectualism of the East Coast,
so
the culture of the East Coast.
It's funny because you mentioned Benchley before, and I think part of Barbara and Ray, part of their style is a very American sort of comedy that's very parallel to the prose comedy that the New Yorker basically invented mm-hmm. in the 20s, where it was a similar thing of a kind of wry befuddlement.
Yes, that's a good way to say it.
And like, you know, Ross was basically like a Midwestern guy in New York.
That's mm-hmm. right.
And there's a very similar kind of tone. And it, like a wonderful underplayed simplicity also read in like E.B. White and Thurber.
But usually,
Benchley's kind of the trippiest of them.
He's the trippiest because he embodied, Benchley embodied it in character.
Right, because Benchley didn't just write it, he also performed it.
He's the most psychedelic of those guys.
Oh, absolutely.
And we'll
oh,
right
good. And
it's a call from beyond. Bob Benchley.
Is it Robert Benchley? I'll have to find out that was the host's phone.
How embarrassing.
At this point, we'd like to
it's
remind you all.
It's not me calling and saying, I'm lost. Good.
It is the asshole host of the podcast. I will apologize.
But you know what's
that.
Interesting about all that is I actually went to at Alan Stevenson, I went to school with some of Benchley's nephews.
Wow.
Two of his nephews. Huh. And, but that's just, again, tangential to all this this mad serendipity that has been the story of my life and still continues. But I performed the Treasurer's Report.
I was just about to mention that because Treasurer's Report is one of the things that makes me think of when they're doing their interviews.
Yeah.
And again, if you were to make the Treasurer's Report a two-person bit, it's Bob and Ray.
That's right.
And then all these sort of little digressions.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
The little
into
interstitial
the telling the story.
You
got
us.
The parrots.
It's just a kind of sensibility that they share.
Oh, I'm sorry. They just told me that Mrs. Blanny has pneumonia.
Right.
Remember, she has
Has
pneumonia.
She has pneumonia.
Anyway, I still remember that bit. I did that as my senior speech at Riverdale Country School, which is the next place that I went and I had an opportunity to you know continue to learn my licks as an actor and not so much a comic. I was the path I took was that of an actor, mm-hmm. but I always was attracted to material that was tongue in cheek. For many years, and I finally said, "No, it's a metaphor, Phil. It's a metaphor."
Buddy Hackett never realized it was a metaphor.
So there you are, finding a character through which you can kind of slide comedy mm-hmm. under the door,
sure.
you know. And what Bob and Ray did with that, with these characters that they created, or what Koch did, mm-hmm. you know, Koch is Koch can. What they did together mm-hmm. was absolutely a wonderful gift to American comedy. And I think one of the reasons why they had such a long, good run mm-hmm. on it was because it was so aggressive, so non-aggressive,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
so subtle.
It mm-hmm. was, yeah.
Really very subtle. Definitely. Ollie Ballou here.
Oh, yeah. Or one of my favorites is just, you know, the junior spot welder. It's like, I'm
in the kitchen now. You know, and it's just all forward.
Oh, Polly, I'm down in the basement.
Oh, all right, I'll let me walk.
Golly!
Right footsteps, that's right.
You know, half the thing is him walking
where are
from
you?
One room.
I'm all over in the furnace. Okay. Yeah,
I'm in the backyard now, Wally, if you could come out here for a moment.
So again, to try to bring these threads together, I would record these shows. The tape that I did put together mm-hmm. became part of Larry Josephson's collection of mm-hmm. Bob and Ray.
Okay.
He put out cassette tapes, and
the old WBAI guy?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Okay. Larry produced
them. I have
them.
Some of those, actually.
Do you?
Yep.
Well, take a look. There's one in there credited to Philip and Audrey Proctor, you know, and that was me and my mom gathering this stuff together.
Oh,
and it includes all of the breakups. Peter Roberts, the newscaster, they used to go in when he was doing his news and crawl under the table, you know, and take his shoes off while he was reading the news, or set fire to his copy, you know, and you hear it, and he had a laugh, which was a ha, 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 ha. funny laugh, and he'd go on laughing until, you know, they just keep the microphone open.
Oh, so my God.
It embarrassed the hell out of him. It's hysterical. So I had all those things. Mm-hmm. Oh, I sent him two postcards. They read them both on the air. And that's included in there, too. Awesome. One of the postcards simply said, get well soon. You know, they read that. And I forget what the other one was, but it's in this particular tape. So the one thing I regret greatly, because they used to have live people on the air, that wonderful singer who sang Popocatépetl, kettle or pan, Popocatépetl. I want to love somebody, can it not be you? Popocatépetl, I love you too. She had a terrible, scratchy, wonderful voice. Her name probably will come to me. But she sang Rats in My Room also. You never heard that?
I don't know. I'm a little showbiz aficionado, and I don't know either of these.
Okay, well, I'll try to remember her name or not. It doesn't. But anyway, she was featured, and she was on the show. They actually had her. And I regret that I didn't have the courage to go down and sit in on the show, because I'm sure I could have done it. They would have welcomed me. Mm-hmm. I did have a chance to meet Bob many years later. Never met Ray, unfortunately, before he passed away. But anyway, that's the only regret I have about it. But I followed their career through all of the various things that they did. There was that other show that they were on, that weekend show. I should have done my research on this.
It's really okay.
You could do your research.
It's a computer. That's the way I know. And I mean, if you have a smartphone, you don't need to remember anything anyway.
But it wasn't called Metro, but it was an NBC or one of those networks used to do a show on the weekend, and they were part of it. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because the Fireside Theater had an opportunity to do some of that, too, on NPR. Uh-huh. You know, we did political comedy as drop-ins on some of their programs, like not All Things Considered, but something like that. A Few Things Considered.
Some things
Think
considered.
About it, yeah.
The world-renowned Komodo Dragon Authority. From Upper Montclair, New Jersey, Dr. Darrell Dexter. Dr. Dexter, would you tell everybody all about the Komodo dragon, please?
The Komodo dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and nearby Rinja, Padar, and Flores. It's a ferocious carnivory, and one swipe of its tail can render an enemy senseless.
Where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, the world's largest living lizard, is found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo, hence its name. And that is in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. We have two in this country, two Komodo dragons, which were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragons. Is that true?
Inspired by Bob and Ray, and then coming out here, I did connect up with Peter Bergman, and I did find out that he was the Wizard of Oz on Radio Free Oz, on KPFK Radio, and he said, why don't you come down and we'll improvise, because he had a lot of hours to fill. I think he was on from midnight to 3 or 4 or something like that.
Prime time.
Yeah. In those days. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, that was prime time. You know? Everybody was up all night on acid, you know, or incense. And that's where I met Phil Austin and David Osman, who had both been working at the station. Mm-hmm. I think it was Austin. He was in charge of, like, the drama of department, okay, uh-huh. and Osman had just been fired or something. But anyway, we discovered we were all fire signs, okay, mm-hmm. I'm a Leo, two Sagittarians, Peter and David, and,
there you go.
And Austin is the Aries.
Yes, for those of you who did not know, it actually comes from the Zodiac.
Fire sign comes
yes.
from the Zodiac.
I
as you know,
no Peter was doing a 60s hippie on.
Absolutely. Isn't that why the Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers cover has you guys all with your...
Yeah.
All
right.
And speaking of great covers, a beautiful Robert Grossman.
Yes.
That's right. Oh, yeah, and Bob Grossman was Peter's roommate at Yale.
Holy cow. Oh, my God. I did not know that.
Yeah. And Peter and I met at Yale because he had done the lyrics for two musicals that I starred in. One was called Tom Jones. This is before the movie.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the other was called Booth is Back in Town. I played Junius Brutus Booth's son, Edmund. And both were musicals, and both were written by Austin Pendleton.
Ah, yeah.
Wow. Austin went on to have an incredible sure. career, and who's one of the sweetest, dearest friends I have. I'm so sorry I don't see more of him, but... I've never seen him in a loincloth, by the way. I've seen more of you than I have of Austin.
See? Austin, you need to get in touch with Phil, all right? Come on.
But
one of those actors that I frequently do when I'm in a jam. Like, Pendleton did. Sort of a mom.
Dropping Austin Pendleton.
Well, I guess I'll just do this.
Yes. And once he got over his stutter.
Really?
You know, he had a terrible stutter back at Yale.
Him and James Earl Jones.
One of his famous latter roles is the stuttering attorney in My Cousin Vinny.
Oh, yes, oh that's right.
I didn't realize how personal that
oh,
was.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh,
yeah. Wow, I forgot
and
about
think,
that
I
one.
Think he, you know, it's a funny thing about actors and their the reality versus the art. I met my wife, Melinda, only because the actress who had originally been cast in this part of a play that we were doing at the Actors Studio West, the Playwrights Division, had to play a Southern role, mm-hmm. and she was from the South, and she didn't want to revert to her Southern accent, so she dropped out. Now think about that. If I was from the South and I was given the chance to do a Southern part, I would just embrace it because I'd get a chance to do some Southern part.
And I think it's too close. There's not enough of a dynamic somehow.
And this like, girl,
I like
by
how
the
you're
way,
justifying this.
This girl is Bob Shea's sister. Bob Shea created Night Flight, which was like one of the first avant-garde cable, if you will, late-night television shows, mm-hmm. and then went on to form a little company called New Line.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, his sister, they're from Georgia or something like that, and his sister is the one who dropped out, and then Melinda Peterson came in. Now, here's what this was about. Again, I mean, my life is so bizarre this way. I had been working with Peter and Phil of the Fireside Theater, and we started a little advertising agency, and we were writing and doing commercials. But I also had a voiceover career doing commercials, and I told them when we started, I said, guys, you know, I don't want to get caught in any conflict of interest nonsense. You know, I want to be able to continue my career independently as Phil Proctor, a voiceover artist, and then we'll do our thing. And a conflict came up, and they got all hard-nosed about it, and I said, okay, you guys carry on. I'm not going to do this anymore. Because I really didn't want, you know, to be working with two father figures. We were all brothers, you know. So I'm sitting at home now. I'm saying, well, what am I going to do now? I'm now, you know, cut off the Fireside Theater. We're not doing records. David's back east doing a radio show. We were doing this advertising. What am I going to do now? And the phone rings. Really. And I pick up the phone. It's a guy named John Acorn, who's a member of the Antillas Company. Mm-hmm. This is before I was in Antillas. And he says, Phil, I'm doing a play reading. Oh, but in my mind, I'm saying, I got to do some readings. Have to get involved in the theater. Have to do some play readings. Ring. Hello, John Acorn. We're doing a play reading at the Actors Studio, and there's a part for you. Would you like to do it? I said, yes, of course. Because that's the way things happened in those days. So I go in to do the play reading, and after the play reading, there's a girl down front, and she says, you don't remember me, but we were at, we studied with Uta Hagen together in New York, in the Village. And I said, yeah, I remember you. Can't remember her name now, of course. But I can see her face, and that's the most important thing. She looked like this.
We're all doing the face, got it? By just good, for good, those good, in good. Home.
No, she didn't look like that. More like...
Oh, like this.
This.
All right, sorry.
Okay. So anyway, but no, wait, you're right, but she colored her hair.
Ah, okay, good.
So she was, anyway, she was an unnatural blonde, all right? So she says to me, I've written a play, I think you'd be really good for the part, can you do a Russian accent? I said, I speak Russian, and yes, I can do a Russian accent, and I sing in Russian, and I do a Russian, fine. And she said, well, that's good, because the last time we did it, the guy couldn't do a Russian accent, and he's supposed to be a Russian. I said, that must have been a problem. So this play, which is called, now, you can't make this stuff up. Nude Radio. Nude Radio.
All right.
This play is about a Russian exchange person who comes over to learn about agriculture. And he meets this pretty southern girl, Southern Belle, in Valdosta, Georgia. And they fall in love. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the first act, they do it. Now, Russians don't do it. They don't do it that's the way we do it, but they do something. It's a 5-year plan. It's a long foreplay. A lot of long foreplay. And then 5 years later, you've got, you know, a baby, if you're lucky. So, anyway, we do this play, and Shay's sister drops out after the first reading of it with the director. And the director says, "Don't worry, I've got somebody who's going to be perfect for this part." In comes Melinda Peterson. Well, it was love at first sight, or at least at second sight. You know, first sight was kind of like, well, I don't know. And second sight was, ooh, yeah. And of course, the whole play is about two people from entirely different worlds coming together and falling in love, mm-hmm. or falling into bed, at least, mm-hmm. which was good enough for me. I had no girlfriends or anything. And so we do the play together. We knew that we had the hots for one another. She's married. I was dancing. I was dating a tap dancer at the time. Don't ask. And
Gregory Hines, I think it was, wasn't it?
And then we go our separate ways, and then I get a phone call from Michael Bell. Michael Bell. And whose daughter, Ashley Bell, by the way, is doing very well. She's in The Last Exorcist. She's the wonderful actress in that. Nice. So anyway, I get a call from Michael Bell. He had a little theater company out at the end of Van Nuys Boulevard called West End Playhouse. He was doing a little play called Ladies of the Camellias. And Melinda had been cast as Eleonora Duse. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Victoria, who's a beautiful actress in so many ways, was playing the French actress, what's her name, Sarah Bernhardt. Mm-hmm. And the whole play, it's a brilliant play by Lillian Garrett, is about these two companies, an Italian company doing Lady of the Camellias and a French company doing Lady of the Camellias, who were coming into Paris at the same time, both extremely famous actresses, Duse and Bernhardt. And so the idea was, all the publicity, you can go see Bernhardt do it, you can go see Duse do it, and they discovered that Duse's theater was not available, mm-hmm. because they'd extended the play that was there. So Bernhardt offered them to both perform, came up with the idea that they'd both perform at the same theater, in alternate performances. Mm-hmm. Well, in this play, the companies are coming together to kind of meet for the first time, and an anarchist student, Russian, mm-hmm. bursts in with a gun and a bomb and is holding them hostage in order to get some of his cohorts released from the Bastille in Paris. Well, Michael Bell got a television show. He was playing the anarchist student, and he gets a television show. So he said, "Could you come in and learn the part and do it for a weekend or something, mm-hmm. you know, at such and such a time?" And I said, "Sure." So here I am again playing another Russian with Melinda Peterson, who's now playing a girl from southern Italy or something. And so we were just thrown together.
The fates are just pushing to get you guys together.
Yeah. It's like, okay, God.
We're going to try this again.
Yep, try it again.
Similar setup.
Yep.
And it worked because we're now celebrating our 20th wedding anniversary.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great.
It worked. And we have been working together at the Antius Company, and we've also had this extraordinary run doing radio drama, live radio theater, really all over the country.
To be perfectly honest with you, I was all set to talk to a young lady. I don't know as my questions are particularly appropriate. Your vital statistics?
7 1/4, 15 1/2, 32.
Let's start at the fundamentals. What's your name and where are you from?
Fonstock P. Beaudry of Moline, Illinois.
Well, congratulations, Fonstock. I have been requested to remind you of the obligations you assumed when you were crowned a few moments ago. You know, of course, you'll be showing your beautiful face all over this country this coming year.
Yes, will I be chaperoned on that tour?
And the most recent manifestation of that was we had done... let me put it this way. Whenever anybody would call me up and say, Phil, I'd like you to do so-and-so, it's a radio thing, I said, I'll do it if my wife can get involved. You know, why not?
Sure.
Yep. And, you know, and so, and that worked. Roger Gregg of the Crazy Dog Audio Theater, an expatriate from American from Detroit, who's been doing incredible, funny, surrealistic, macabre comedy on the radio in Dublin, wow, for the last 20 years now, I guess, called me up because I'm a judge for a thing called the Mark Time Awards, mm-hmm, which are awards for radio drama in fantasy and in science fiction, fantasy horror and science fiction.
Do they take the name from the Fireside Theater sketch when you do Mark
Time?
Well,
yeah, David Osman created it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I just got a box full of CDs of these radio shows that I have to listen to. Sometimes they come from Belgium, you know, they have to be in English, but, mm-hmm, but Belgium and Australia, of course, in which case the CD can only be played on the Down Under side.
Thank you.
And all over the United States, you know, and England, mm-hmm, and Ireland. And so I'd heard one of Roger Gregg's pieces, which was totally brilliant, the production and the writing and the levels of surrealism and comedy. So I sent him an email, or if there was such a thing in those days, I sent him an email letter.
A telegram.
An elegram. Yes. And he got back to me and said, look, I do this radio show every summer in Dublin, and would you like to do something in it? And I said, sure, if my wife can do it too. Mm-hmm. And he said, fine. So he wrote a piece for me and my wife playing American characters, a comic horror piece, which is his métier. And we paid for our own flights over, but we were paid to do it. Mm-hmm. And we performed it live out at the NRK, that's in Norway, at RTE, Radio and Television Éireann, you know, Ireland. Mm-hmm. Out of the studio with a live audience. Now, the reason that I was able to be cast in this was because of the Rugrats. Mm-hmm. See? Now, I played Howard on the Rugrats for 14 years. And at this time, which is now, you know, maybe, what, 10 years ago or something, they were showing it in Ireland. And it was a big hit.
Huh.
So I was Phil Proctor of the Rugrats is going to come over and be on a radio show. And I did the television show. I did the most popular kids television show, which is these two crazy guys, one of whom does the voice of a sock puppet, which is a puppet made up of socks, just hanging socks all over him.
Oh, God.
And the other one is a turkey that speaks in Irish, you know, Celtic. You know. And I was on that show with them, and I did a bunch of radio shows, call-in shows, and all that stuff, and got to perform with my wife doing this radio gig, and that turned into, like, we did that for 5 years. Every summer we'd fly over to Dublin, do a radio show. Sometimes it was recorded, you know, live. Sometimes it was recorded as a record. Sometimes, mm-hmm, it had music in it. I mean, they were all brilliant, so cool, brilliant shows. And then we'd take our Euros, mm-hmm, and travel around Europe, you know, do something with them. Give them to the Europeans. We can't take this home. It's a Euro, you know. It's for you. So anyway, that was a great, great run. And that all came out of, again, out of this radio instinct. Well, years later, David Osman and his wife Judith Walcott got hired to produce and direct a bunch of audio pieces before a live audience at the International Mystery Writers Festival in Owensboro, Kentucky, which is a beautiful $3 million facility called River Park Center, right on the Ohio River across from Evansville, Indiana, my home state.
Uh-huh.
And so about 4 or 5 years, we would go down there in June or July and perform adaptations of screenplays, short stories, plays, what else, what other form? comic books, you know, graphic novels, mm-hmm. done as a radio show. Mm-hmm. And one year, Harry Anderson was our guest star. He's a friend of Firesign's. We met him through Procter & Bergman and actually said, you really should come to Hollywood. You've got great talent. Woo-hoo!
And then Night Court.
Next thing I know, I'm doing guest stars on Night Court. You know, yeah! The secret to my success. Anyway, so out of this, and Melinda and I are doing these shows, out of this came a piece called Agatha Christie's BBC Murders. And that is comprised of four radio shows that she wrote, Agatha Christie wrote, for the BBC mm-hmm. from 1934 to like 1957. And Melinda plays Agatha and introduces each one of these little radio plays. One of the radio plays is called Three Blind Mice, which became The Mousetrap.
Right.
Okay. The longest running play in the history of the world, mm-hmm. still in the West End. I saw it a couple of years ago, and I saw it in 1957 with my mom back in London. Amazing.
Wow.
And the actors are getting a little old for the part. One of them was dead, but you know, it's a mystery. So I just,
hey, work is work.
The mouse can barely
That's right.
Him.
That's right. Yes, there you are. Yeah. The mouse is. Okay. So anyway, we just performed that down at in Florida, two mm-hmm. venues. Clearwater, Florida, at the Capitol Theater, which is like a 100-year-old vaudeville house, mm-hmm. 450 seats, now being converted into a 750-seat theater. And then we went to Fort Lauderdale, mm-hmm. and we performed at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale for 3 weeks, which is a huge playhouse, 1,100 seats. And I had performed there during the inaugural season of this theater in 1967. When I was 27 years old, I did a play with Bob Cummings called Generation mm-hmm. on the very same boards. It's so amazing. Now, the reason why this all happened is a guy named Zev Buffman. Zev Buffman, who is in his 80s now, I call him the oldest living Jewish leprechaun. That's what he looks like. He's a little man, handsome, vivacious.
That's another Bob and Ray name, too. Now Zev Buffman.
Zev Buffman.
Zev.
The author of How to
Buff Your Shoes.
Right. Yes. And then you say, hi, I'm Zev. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
So Zev, he has been in the business forever, as obviously implied by his name, but he's a producer. And he used to send us out on bus and truck tours when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he had all these theaters down in Florida. The Coconut Grove, the Parker Playhouse, and another one, Royal Poinciana Playhouse. Okay. And whenever I would do tours, major tours, that involved Florida, we would do all those, we'd do that circuit, mm-hmm. okay? So here I am many years later. Zev Buffman had gone to visit his sister, who was ailing in Owensboro, Kentucky, and before you know it, he became the artistic director of the River Park Center. Mm-hmm. That just shows you what a guy he is. Mm-hmm. And he created the International Mystery Writers Festival. And David and Judith were hired by him to do this thing, and the alliance became immediate. You know, everybody just worked together so well that we continued doing it. And this is because Kentucky became poorer, you know, they started taking the money away to help underwrite this festival. Mm-hmm. So Zev had to leave the gig and went back to Florida, and he's now the artistic director at Ruth Eckert Hall, which is basically a venue for traveling shows and concerts and comics and things. But he has now introduced, he's making it into a producing entity. Mm-hmm. And that's why we did the Agatha Christie piece down there, mm-hmm. which is designed to tour. So in 2014, we expect and are very hopeful that we'll be touring around the country, maybe even Canada, doing this show, which could also be done in England, by the way. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful show. And one of the stars of the show is a guy named Gary Sandy, who was the boy toy on WKRP.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course.
And has matured into, well, he's very immature, thank God. But he has, we would say metaphorically, matured into an excellent character actor. Mm-hmm. and he's like a leading man.
How's his hair these days?
Oh, he has great hair. He has not lost one follicle.
A little salt and peppery today.
Oh my God! Not much. Not much.
Hey, that comes and goes. I've been watching Alec Baldwin on 30 Rock, and his hair color has come back very nicely over the last couple of years.
The roots get darker and they grow in.
I think that's an all carrot diet or something that does that.
Well, it's a carrot dye. No, Gary has all his hair and almost all of the color of his hair. I think he's beginning to get a little gray in the temples, you know, but he's not even Jewish, so I don't understand that. But he's a brilliant member of the cast. And Melinda is absolutely killer as Agatha Christie. If you go to my website, planetproctor.com, and check out the last couple of issues from last year of Planet Proctor, you'll see pictures of us.
No, but would you sit there now and tell us your name, please?
Harlow P. Whitcomb.
And where are you from?
From Glens Falls.
New York.
New York.
And what do you do?
I am the president and recording
secretary.
Secretary of the STOA.
What does that stand for?
Slow Talkers of America. We believe
in speaking slowly,
in forming
your words, thoughts,
our ideas and opinions clearly before
speaking.
We speak.
I get to play Hercule Poirot. Nice. Among other characters. It's very funny.
You've been so immersed in like all facets of show business. Yeah, and like, one of the great things about Firesign
like
is, we were talking about this earlier, there's a sort of, you're sort of like in the 70s, you're kind of young guys referencing this sort of classic American stuff that you grew up hearing, or that was even happening when you were very little children. And there's a kind of humorous detachment from that, but there's also, it's also clearly a great love of that.
Right.
Yes.
And these kind of classic radio forms that you're kind of giddily remembering in a kind of psychedelic haze.
Well, it's...
I mean, there's a kind of surrealist framing of it in
Fireside.
Yeah, there's
a dissonance and a kind of a what do they call it now? They don't call it schizophrenia anymore.
Bipolar?
Bipolar.
Yeah.
Is it a bipolar...
Oh, indeed.
Attachment to it, a bipolar take on it. And that was actually also epitomized by the fact that one of the things I love to do with early Fireside Theater was to read notes that I found on the street written by psychotic people. You know? like a bridge. You know?
Fascinating. And they introduced that as...
I introduced that as human beings, the mind, how the mind matters. And, of course, the thing that was so great about Firesign, which is different from Bob and Ray, was that we were able to improvise off of one another so easily.
Yeah.
You know, now obviously, but one of the reasons Bob and Ray are so very successful is that they had this mind meld, and they instantly knew what characters to become and how to, you know, to play off of one another, whether the material was placed in front of them or whether it came out of their own heads. But their banter in between all on their radio show was always high and funny and fast and interesting. And they
both came from they were broadcasters when they met.
Yeah.
They're pretty much straight broadcasters.
Yeah.
Like they were like newsmen and then but what they started doing immediately, a big theme of their work is making fun
of
broadcasting
the news media,
the Gila Monster sketch.
Right. Yeah.
About the which hasn't dated a second because it's still about a broadcaster who doesn't listen.
It's so funny.
In a sense, the Ron Burgundy
you got it.
Go right. Fuck yourself San Diego joke is yeah. a parallel
right.
to that.
Or if
the empty-headed newsreader
true.
Or says what's in front of him. Or
Harry Shearer, I think he does it in Wayne's World. Like it's like, oh, so you're not listening at all to us. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, and so right. now I can say whatever I want. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, keep going.
One of Harry's most brilliant pieces was on Saturday Night Live where he played the DJ interviewing the traveling musician.
Right.
And he's dealing with the cars
and the levels and everything
and
else.
His record up, you know, and right. yeah.
Uh-huh. That's going to be great. Very interesting.
Brilliant, totally.
Yeah.
Totally brilliant.
But the thing, like, they're actually making fun of, like, they're sort of World War II generation right. guys who are making fun of the tropes of their generation, whereas right. you guys are kind of referencing an earlier generation's style through your own perspective.
But we also created these characters, Harold Hippugger and Ray Hamburger, who were newsmen mm-hmm. and were trying to stick to their, you know, script and to their attitudes and everything, but had a banter between them and a relationship. Later it turned out these are continuing characters in Firesign Saga, and turns out they were gay and living together, you know. And so when we did our radio show Fools in Space for XM Radio, those characters were able to come out in improvisation and writing special material for one another. The whole history of the Firesign Theater and radio is an amazing thing because we kind of like we're writing for one another,
mm-hmm.
and also for ourselves in relationship to one another because we knew what kind of an effect certain material was going to have on the improvisation
well, and,
of the day.
And it's right? one of the things that I love about your older stuff is when you have those moments, you know, and it's like in Dear Friends or
yeah.
when you see that moment where somebody has written something that's so locks into somebody else's sense of humor.
Right.
I think it was like the wipe off pumice hamburgers.
Yes.
And then you just hear somebody, I don't know what it is, right. start cackling and somebody goes, yeah. oh, that's great, who wrote that?
It's usually Austin.
Yeah.
But the chinchilla bit was something, I wrote that bit and just threw the pages out at everybody.
Which is one of my favorite,
mine
the Alistair
too.
Blue synthetic chinchilla bit is one of the greatest Fireside Theater. It's
played straight.
Oh, and you can hear people trying to hold it together.
Oh, yeah.
And now here's
one
thing that I had to bring up that I actually leaked to these guys before you showed up. And it goes to show how much of a fan you guys are of Bob and Ray, especially you.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy's voice from the Nick Danger stuff, it's almost
Mary
exactly
and
like
the
Ray's.
Ray's
female
falsetto.
Voice than it does. I mean, it was amazing when I was listening to it, and it's funny because I was a fan of Firesign Theater before I went to Bob and Ray, so my first thing when I heard Ray doing the voice, I'm like, he's stealing Phil's voice. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's a progression to this.
Yeah.
Hold on.
A lot of the great comics were emulating a comic hero,
sure,
you know, or a style, a comic style, to kind of get them into the groove.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the funniest story about this to me is a guy named Bill Farmer, and Bill Farmer has been one of the voices of Goofy for Disney for decades. And in fact, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award for being Goofy.
that phrase in and of itself
yes.
belongs on a sampler.
So
or,
should we all.
Yes,
alongside
exactly.
Betty White.
Yeah.
She got her award at the same time. And I toured with Betty White in Bell, Book, and Candle. That's another. I'll tell you a story about that if we have time. We have nothing but
touring with Betty White is probably a whole other podcast.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine.
Oh, which I want to hear.
What fun. So, but getting back to whatever I was talking about. What was I talking about? Let's see. We're not touring with Betty White now.
Influences.
Who was it?
Generally influences.
To the female voice.
That's what
I female right. voices.
Yes,
oh, yeah, influence.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, Bill Farmer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
right.
Bill Farmer, the voice of Goofy. Well, he came out, Bill's from a rural part of America. And he came out to Hollywood. I don't know exactly what brought him out, but this is a story he tells on himself. And one of the first readings that he got was at Disney, where they were looking for somebody to replace Cal, I think his name was, the guy who used to do Goofy, who
mm-hmm.
passed away. And although they tried to get his voice from beyond, it was too much static.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go. So Bill comes in and he's reading for Goofy, and they put him in a little room. And there's drawings of Goofy
mm-hmm.
and the copy. And Bill says, I looked at the drawings and I looked at the copy and I said, oh my God, I hope they're not going to ask me to draw the character. That is how naive he was when he first came out. Oh,
shit. That's our Goofy.
Perfect. You got the gig.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
So, but that's true that so many people who got into the voiceover industry and all of that basically imitated the voices that
well,
they
a lot of classic like cartoon characters. There's a lot of TV cartoon characters in like the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, guys like Dawes Butler were kind of doing Phil Silvers.
You got, yeah, exactly. Like, just and right. I mean, even now, and by now I mean 20 years ago, but like The Simpsons, you know, I mean...
By
got,
now you mean 20 years ago?
Well, I mean, The Simpsons has been on for 25 years. Isn't that crazy?
The influence for the Homer Simpson voice was originally Matthew.
Right, but I mean, but you can get even to the more obvious ones like Wiggum, you know, who's obviously, you know, Edward G. Robinson, you know, I mean, just like those really strong, those strong character voices. Or, you know...
Well, Rocky Rococo.
Exactly. Is
based on... Peter Lorre.
Peter Lorre, yeah.
And it's true.
Mr. Danger.
Mr. Danger. You know, yes, these kind of classic...
What about my pickle?
Iconic characters that are stuck in your head.
Sure.
You know, and...
But you're ironically probably more familiar with than the people who created them or were them.
Yeah.
You know.
So the people actually think that maybe we created them.
Right. This is a thing. Fine. It's certainly a thing for me. It's kind of a generational thing, is growing up knowing that, like you talked about, knowing Fire Sign first.
Right.
But like knowing the parody of something before you know the original.
Exactly.
Right?
Well,
oh,
I mean,
that's what that voice
and,
was
and
referring
to. And for me, the one that was the most embarrassing was when my father sat me down to watch Blazing Saddles when I was about 11, 12, 13 years old. And it gets to this scene where he's signing up all of the bad guys to come raid the town.
Yep.
And then the Mexicans show up and they're like, here are your badges. And they go, badges?
Right.
You don't need no stinking badges. And so then I see Treasure of the Sierra Madre 6 years later and I go, how did this black and white film steal from Mel Brooks so effectively?
Well, then take somebody who's 10, 15 years younger than us who's also seen the Weird Al movie UHF first. And they think,
but you see,
this, and Jeremy is a classic example of this with his temporal he's temporally challenged.
Yeah,
I was 11, 12, or 13. It was 20 years ago, or is it now?
Right,
it's
right.
Now, 20. Now, see what's happened is
it all folds back in on itself.
Not only that, but we live in a time of jumble.
For
it's
sure.
a jungle of jumbled time.
Yeah,
because you now have access to all this history, this visual and audio history.
Right, you can go on Netflix and see Peter Lorre in M.
Absolutely.
Or see Peter Lorre in Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah,
you know, because he's the voice of Ren.
That's right,
you know?
which was probably inspired by Rocky Rococo.
Absolutely.
At the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And it is. It's absolutely phenomenal and really wonderful to be able to reference all of these things and be inspired by things of the past and the present and all mixed up in such a way that the quality of a time flow doesn't have the same significance at all anymore.
Right? Yeah.
The Eastern Regional Coordinator of Interbureau Administration for the Northeast States, Southern Indiana, and Ohio. And I refer to Mr. Clyde L. Happ Watney. Happ, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I want you to know that everybody in Washington watches your show all the time.
Good to know.
Now, I've taken the liberties to go ahead here and prepare some questions and answers so that there will be no misunderstanding as to what we do down there in Washington, in our office, exactly what we do.
Well, I was going to just fire away questions at you.
Now, if you'll, right here where I have Bob, that's for you, then I have the answers written down here.
Okay, App. There seems to be some confusion in many circles as to the responsibility of the Federal Reserve Board and Bank vis-a-vis as to the World Bank. Could you clear it up for us?
I'm glad you asked me that question. The Federal Reserve Board is a semi-quasi-governmental agency that operates the Federal Reserve Bank and also proposes interest rates that member institutions should charge.
And the World Bank.
I was getting to that.
Hey, how did you guys? I mean, how did you guys write that stuff? The old Fire Sign stuff.
Well, we sat around a table with a nice joint and some El Presidente brandy, you know, and
lubricated your imagination.
Top shelf. Well, because it was a long process. Let's see. How can I best explain the way all that happened?
Because there's
it's got this amazing combination of sort of spontaneous stream of consciousness and a rigorously structured style, which is such a great dynamic.
Well, it's a meld of actual theater and skit form presentation with free-flying consciousness, mind association, psychedelic comedy structure, non-structure, surrealistic structure. If anybody knows the Goon Shows, that was the inspiration. It wasn't so much like we have to be like these guys. It was like we are these guys.
Right.
This is the way we think. This is the way we feel about comedy. And we immediately know that there were absolute masters of this form, especially Spike Milligan, who created so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
My God, the comedy that they came up with and that whole run. Peter got to work with Spike Milligan in London briefly once.
Wow.
But that was the major inspiration why, we can do this. Somebody else did it. We can do it. And so we would do it live. Peter Bergman's Radio Free Eye Show went through many different manifestations. From the late night show, sitting around a table with incense burning, just, riffing off of our minds late at night, and pretending to be other characters and doing whatever we wanted, to the Oz Film Festival showing movies on the radio. We showed one movie. Phil Austin played a character in the Oz Film Festival, which was, he was doing adult films before there were adult films.
Uh-huh.
And so we showed one of his movies, Blondie Pays the Rent. It was a dentist, with an unconscious woman and the thing. And after we showed a clip of that on the radio, somebody called up and said, "How dare you show, a pornographic movie on the radio?"
Jesus.
And we went, "Oh boy, we're on to something here."
It's like when I see those Onion articles online and people responding to them as if they're real. It's like, why are we spending this much on an abortion plex?
That's the inspiration of Bob and Ray, making it sound real.
Yeah.
And we carried it even further because we made Kitty Cat. there's a kitty cat here.
Yes, there is.
We would create a very real sounding commercial that was, of course, maybe for marijuana cigarettes, or just was bending the mind out into some entirely different place. Yeah. We did it in order to kind of de-brainwash people, to break the thrall of a commercialism on the American mind, and also to of course make you laugh. Because laughing is releasing. Once you laugh, you let it go. Or you recognize something and let it go. So we carried it that one step further. But at the time that we were doing all of this, we also would perform as much as we could. We used to go down to a club called... it's now the Improv. It's the same place where the Improv Comedy Club is located. But then it was called the Ash Grove, which is ironic. The Firesign Theater playing the Ash Grove,
that's nice.
which a guy named Pearl used to run, and he was very revolutionary. And the Ash Grove was burned down twice, reduced to ashes, and then they rebuilt it. And that's where we would try out our material.
Uh-huh.
This was based on Peter Bergman's assumption that the Marx Brothers used to try out their material
shop at
the Libero Theater in Santa Barbara before they put it on film or take it on tour or whatever.
Except for Duck Soup. I think that was the only one they did straight.
Okay.
Straight up. Okay. Everything else, yeah.
They did do that. And so that was our model as well. The piece, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, which was inducted into the Library of Congress about 5 years ago.
And I believe was voted Time Magazine's greatest comedy album ever.
That's true.
Wow.
That's true.
Awesome.
Yep. Well, it's an historical or hysterical recording now.
Both.
But that was called originally A Life in the Day, inspired by the Beatles, The Day of the Life.
Right.
And the Beatles were a great inspiration to us all, by the way.
Because you guys reference them constantly.
Oh, yeah, because they were doing psychedelic music.
Yes, and there is a parallel to that. If Bob and Ray are kind of bop, sort of a wonderfully understated, very clean kind of thing, you guys sort of parallel the kind of FM progressive rock thing that was happening, where you talk about bending time, but you actually Some of the bits are just about sustaining a tone.
Yeah.
And beautifully and hilariously. Well, and so it's like really does much. Parallel and that's sort of what was going on musically.
And I love how you're
in radio where like you could play a 20-minute song.
Right. Exactly. You could play In the God of DeVita from beginning to end and nobody would get mad.
If Peter used to do that regularly on Radio Free Asha, we'd put on a Ravi Shankar
Raga,
and we'd go out and smoke for 20 minutes. And then back
but what's so beautiful about it is you're all masters of a kind of old school dialect.
Yes.
There's a kind of formal tone that goes in there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The form is important.
That gives it such a wonderful kind of rigorous structure to it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that a lot of people...
So it's not just sort of hippie dicking around.
No, because and even all of the Beatles references that you guys put in, it's
Who
never...
Could you?
Yeah, you, but you never... Right. But exactly, you never just throw them in. They're always something... Even in Nick Danger, everyone knew her as Nancy.
That's right.
You know, I mean, like, it's right in there. And so... Even the reverential stuff, you guys find a way to make it work within your narrative. It's not just a throw-in or a throw-away.
No, that's right. And that came out of the theatrical structure that we found important in presenting something to an audience. Okay. We also did the Giant Rat of Sumatra, which was it's called By the Light of the Silvery. And I think we're either getting ready to release all of these original... little radio pieces that we have, the little radio skits, or we've released them already. I don't know. Look out there!
No, Giant Rat is out. I think you guys have released that.
But Giant Rat was released as an album.
Right.
But I'm talking about By the Light of the Silvery.
Oh, the tiny
See,
things.
we've managed to gather together as many of those original recordings because we performed them live before an audience. At the Magic Mushroom, which is a club over in Ventura Boulevard. I started to say that Peter's show evolved into a commercial radio show.
Uh-huh.
And it was on KRLA for a while. Nick Danger came out of the fact that we were on KRLA radio out in Pasadena, I think it was. And it was a weekend show at that time or something. We wrote Nick Danger to become a serial on the show. And we got out there to perform it, and the doors had been locked. The station had changed overnight into, I don't know, acid, Hasidic, country western or something, you know? So we were locked out, and that's why that ended up on the second side of the album when the album said two sides.
Oh, yes. We gotta do something with this.
And that turned out to be our most accessible
iconic Fireside Theater.
So you know, if you have a lemon, you know, make. Kool-Aid, so and drink it. It evolved into the Magic Mushroom Show, where we would from the Magic Mushroom Show to KRLA. But at the Magic Mushroom Show, we did a goon type show. We did a little half hour, 20-minute skit as part of the show, and that show is Prairie Home Companion,
mm-hmm.
back in 1968 or something like that. Because Peter, who was the host, we'd have musical guests on, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And maybe in Young at that time, now in Old, and Mama Cass, you know, and there'd be singing and interviews and then skits and then a fake panel of experts where we'd all play, you know. So it was a weekly show.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it ever got into syndication or not, but anyway, we evolved working both on the radio, doing regular radio shows where audiences would be lying around on the floor in our studio, laughing under the table, you know, and these presentations of our record ideas on stage,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes some of the record ideas would evolve out of improvisation on the radio. So we were this machine, this wonderful, well-oiled machine. We were smoking, man. and we were just cranking this stuff
out. Yeah, you were just producing stuff.
Oh, my God. And then Phil Austin is musically gifted, so he would add musical elements to it. I'm musically gifted, and I was able to add musical elements to it. David reluctantly came along. Peter, also musically gifted, was part of it. So that's where we created the Eight Shoes, which was our entire musical show at the Roxy that we did.
I'd like to have you meet a gentleman who signs his card saying that he's here in this country with a troupe of performing French poodles and he signs in as Maitland W. Montmorency. Would you welcome him, please? Maitland, come on up.
My name is John W. Norbus. I have terrible handwriting.
Okay, John. I notice in looking at your card again that before you got into this dog act, you had something to do with parakeets, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I was a parakeet trainer.
What does that involve, John?
Well, it involves a parakeet. And a cage. And a chair and a whip. And a pistol. And some newspaper.
That became Fighting Clowns.
Fighting Clowns, oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
With cover art by the late Phil Hartman.
Yeah, right. Which is great. It's one of it's such a great cover.
I know, he was so talented. That's tragic and stupid.
No, just it's the worst.
But anyway, ever. All of these things happen. You're asking me about like how do we this all came out of James, your question is how we got together.
Yeah, all the creative stuff. Yeah.
We had from knowing Peter Bergman at Yale, going on his show, meeting the other guys, starting to improvise our material in front of people, which at that time was very primitive. We did a skit called Waiting for the Electrician at UCLA, I think, in a student union, playing this Middle Eastern European theater troupe that had been stranded in the United States because of the revolution and whatever, and they didn't speak English too well, so we'd do pantomime of our shows. Anyway, pardon me, out of that came the basis for Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him. Now, at that time, I can't remember exactly how this happened either, but I was back in New York, went back to New York, I think just to close up my apartment in the Village. I lived right up the street from the White Horse Cafe, where Dylan Thomas,
yes, famously used to hang
out and everything, or throw up, and
little from column.
And I was living with a girl named Diana Dew, who had invented electric clothing, and these were disco dresses that you could control the flow of the electricity around the dress in a rhythmic pattern, and she used translucent plastic strips that held a charge.
Proto rave wear.
Wow.
And I had met her through my friend Brandon DeWilda. Oh, God, there's so many. I mean, the way I met Peter was through Brandon DeWilda and Peter Fonda. When Peter was doing research for his movie, Easy Rider, and we were part of the Sunset Strip riot, the so-called Sunset Strip riot, which was protesting a curfew on young people. And I sat on an open issue of the LA Free Press and a picture of Peter Bergman. Pulled it out from under my ass. And I sat on Peter Bergman. And that's where I learned he was a KPFK. And the next day I was on the show. And that's how that all happened. Wow. But at this point I was living with Diana Dew and our relation in the East Village and hanging out with everybody at Max's Kansas City. And oh my God, it was just such a wonderful, creative, bohemian time. And at a certain point, I just knew the relationship had now ended. And at that very moment, the phone rang, and I picked it up, or she picked it up, and said, "It's for you." It was Peter Bergman, back in L.A. I'm in New York. And he says, "Phil, there's a one-way ticket, airline ticket, waiting for you down at Black Rock, CBS, in New York. Fly back here. We're going to do our first album. We're calling it Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him." And so, again, serendipity in the air, magic creation. It's just the way it still happens like that for me. But then it was like, whoosh, all, you know, the invisible world rules, you know, and higher consciousness. As long as you're up in that little stream, that little jet stream up there. This was before email. Mm-hmm. It was me-mail.
Indeed.
You know?
Well, you're just part of a community.
They call it an iPhone. This was, you know, my phone. It was an iPhone. It was just like, you phone it in. There it is. So, back I went, did the album. Gary Usher produced it.
the rest of that story is another whole interview. But that's where it began, mm-hmm. and how it began. And I have to leave. Peter Bergman passed away on March 9th. Mm-hmm. It's March 16th right now. I was in Goshen, Indiana on March 8th performing in my hometown with the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet. And the next, and that midnight, that night, we were at a party. And I raised my glass to Peter, mm-hmm. who's from Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And now, today, and on March the 8th was also the premiere of this little movie, Oz the Great and Powerful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Peter Bergman was the Wizard of Oz. And now I have to leave to go see the Wizard of Oz at a screening at the Writers Guild.
Very nice.
So
in 3D?
I hope Peter enjoys it in 3D.
Then he will enjoy it.
Well, Peter's enjoying it in 4D.
Someday we shall all enjoy 4D.
And I can tell you some absolutely startling and amazing stories about Peter's presence after he left us, which have made me, at least, absolutely convinced that there's life beyond death.
I bet.
I'll tell you one of them, and then I'll have to leave. Hello, I must be going. there's a woman named Gretchen Steiner who was related to Rudolf Steiner, who was a great mystic of his time and who wrote books about the life after death. Mm-hmm. And Gretchen has become kind of a patron of the Firesign Theater and befriended Peter and has helped his daughter Lily after Peter's passing to get her, you know, her new life alone going. And one night she had a dream after Peter passed away, in which Peter complained that he never got his fortune cookie. And so she made up fortune cookies for his tributes. We did two tributes to Peter. And by the way, the major tribute, which we did at the Kirkland Arts Center up in Washington, will be available for download very soon. We just Great. Finished post-production on it. Yeah. It's an amazing show of remembrances and stories of Peter and us performing Peter's material as best we can and all of that. So anyway, she made up fortune cookies for the people at the tributes. And she and I said, well, what's that all about? And she told me this story. She mm-hmm. had this dream. And I said, oh, well, you know what that is, don't you? She said, no. Peter and I survived the Golden Dragon Massacre at a Chinese restaurant up in San Francisco in 1975, I think it was. 5 people killed, 11 wounded. At that time, the worst massacre in American history, which unfortunately has been, you know,
grossly overreached now, which is disgusting.
Yeah, disgusting. But that was his joke. We never got our fortune cookie.
Holy shit!
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. You explain that one.
Uh-huh. I won't.
You explain that one.
I mean, like, if that's not, you know, the quintessential turning your own tragedy into your comedy.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, like,
how
that's
it. How can you be in two places at once? You're not anywhere at all.
There it is.
Yeah. But
that whole story is Firesign-esque.
Yes.
Because there's also a wonderful, deeply emotional quality to your work, and mm-hmm. and there's a sort of...
You're going to make me cry.
But there is. And there is. There's a kind of theme of yearning. That you find in a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean,
a kind of yearning for the past, just a kind of unspoken.
And just can I just mirror exactly what you're saying using your own stuff? One of my favorite things in the world is the end of "Don't Crush That Door, Hand Me the Pliers," mm-hmm. when the ice cream truck comes.
Yes,
yeah,
and right. it turns into this old man going yeah. back to his youth.
Yeah.
It is mm-hmm. beautiful. And at yeah, the end of such true. A brilliant comedy album, to end with something so stark and just mm-hmm. so beautiful and simple.
Hey, mister, exactly. wait for me.
You got it. And yeah. and you can, again, it's the change in the voice. Going from, oh, wait, I was just, hey, mister, can wait for me. Right?
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all those albums, by the way, that trilogy or quadrology, whatever it is, they all link together. If yeah. you listen to the beginning of the end of each album and the beginning of each album, you'll see that there's an overlap.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, the classic bit where the Nick Danger gets the phone call.
Right.
Pizza.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know.
That's stupid.
The phone call's in one record and then the guy getting it is on
right.
another one.
Right. Yeah. Or the other one, it's like when they're speaking backwards. It's like, what is it? Oh, they're speaking Chinese.
Yeah, yeah, the other side of the
right
record.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I can leave you with this, which is something that people can do. Anybody who has an iPhone, if you say to Siri, Hello, this is Worker speaking. Hello. She will answer, hello, Ah Clem. What can I do for you?
Ah. Maintenance awesome. Open for a realignment. Yeah.
Now, why? Why did that happen? I remember I did a lot of voices for the Pixar movies.
Yes.
And Steve Jobs became an owner of Pixar, right. Investor in Pixar. I met him at one of the openings. I think it was Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo, up in San Francisco at a big party that they had. And he said he was a big Firesign fan when he met me, which knocked me over.
Wow.
And he was a big fan of, I think, Roald Bozo's On This Bus.
Which is great.
And that's why he put the homage into the
That's
phone.
So great. That's amazing.
Now I have to go out, now I have to ask everybody to say this is Worker.
This Worker speaking. Hello.
Mr. R. Clem, if you could please report at the hospitality shelter.
That's right. And just the other day, I found a stack of my notebooks from the 60s, and I found the original piece of material that had the Worker speaking, Unhappy Mac Nam, all of that stuff in it. I took a picture of it and posted it on Facebook.
I gotta see that.
Oh yeah, please go to my Facebook page. I've really gotten into doing things on the Facebook page, and I'm getting very nice responses from it. And it's like our Firesign stuff. It's a mixture of satirical stuff and artistic stuff and political stuff and found stuff and stuff from other posts that I think is pertinent. But this whole social networking thing and this whole violation of time is absolutely the most important thing that's happened to consciousness. And I, for those of you who don't know the work of Marshall McLuhan, you know, he predicted all this stuff. Yeah. And I had a chance to meet him.
Oh, wow.
Peter and I were invited to his private chambers up at the university in Toronto, where he was. I think it was Toronto. And he gave us both Cuban cigars from his vault. He had a vault.
His chair must feel like going to the Thatcher Library.
You enjoyed a very rare privilege. We were having high tea.
Marshall McLuhan.
And we were being served by a liveried manservant who was working for him. He's a professor. And we're smoking our cigars, and all of a sudden, bang, bang! The place loads in there. Because the whole reason McLuhan wanted to get in touch with Proctor and Bergman was because he wanted to add more comedy to his lectures.
Oh my God.
So he was asking us for advice.
He gave you Warner Brothers cigars? Right. I did that to my mother once.
He wanted to get a comedy. He's a bit Nanny Hall.
I gotta go. I got a date with a wizard.
All right.
I'm going up in the balloon.
You go.
Thank you for this. This has been an honor.
My pleasure. We must do it again.
Yes, sir.
Now that I know where you are.
And everybody, thanks for listening.
And we should just redo Great Bob and Ray bits.
Awesome. As always, everybody, have a good thing.
Yes, have a good
thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, rate us highly, and write your reviews. You can follow us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl and Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl.
Yes, she shouted out with me. Up came a happy, he threw me in the cut. The only thing that kept me afloat was only me coconut.